Even as she wondered, drifting smoke images seemed to fall together around her. Mist patterns flowed, solidified, became a shape. Athaclena suddenly found she could visualize herself standing in a small boat, and in her hands she held an oar. Was this how Unsaltlan manifested in the human's mind? As a metaphor? Amazed, she began to row upstream into the stinging maelstrom. Forms floated by, crowding and jostling in the fog surrounding her. Now one blur drifted past as a distorted face. Next, some bizarre animal figure snarled at her. Most of the grotesque things she glimpsed could never have existed in any real universe. Unaccustomed to visualizing the networks of a mind, it took Athaclena some moments to realize that the shapes represented memories, conflicts, emotions. So many emotions. Athaclena felt an urge to flee. One might go mad in this place. It was Timbrimi curiosity that made her stay. That and duty.
"This is so strange,"
she thought as she rowed through the metaphorical swamp. Half blinded by drifting drops of pain, she stared in wonderment. Oh, to be a true telepath and know, instead of having to guess, what all these symbols meant. There were easily as many drives as in a Timbrimi mind. Some of the strange images and sensations struck her as familiar. Perhaps they hearkened back to times before her race or Robert's learned speech. Her own people by uplift, and humans doing it the hard way, back when two tribes of clever animals lived very similar lives in the wild, on far separated worlds. It was most odd seeing with two pairs of eyes at once. There was the set that looked in amazement about the metaphorical realm, and her real pair, which saw Robert's face inches from her own, under the canopy of her corona. The human blinked rapidly. He had stopped counting in his confusion. She at least understood some of what was happening, but Robert was feeling something truly bizarre. A word came to her. Déjà vu. Quick half-rememberings of things at once both new and old. Athaclena concentrated and crafted a delicate glyph, a fluttering beacon to beat in resonance with his deepest brain harmonic. Robert gasped, and she felt him reach out after it. His metaphorical self took shape alongside her in the little boat, holding another oar. It seemed to be the way of things at this level that he did not even ask how he came to be there. Together they cast off through the flood of pain, the torrent from his broken arm. They had to row through a swirling cloud of agonies, which struck and bit at them like swarms of vampire bugs. There were obstacles, snags, and eddies where strange voices muttered sullenly out of dark depths. Finally they came to a pool, the center of the problem. At its bottom lay the gestalt image of an iron grating set in a stony floor. Horrible debris obstructed the drain. Robert quailed back in alarm. Athaclena knew these had to be emotion-laden memories, their fearsomeness given shape in teeth and claws and bloated awful faces. How could humans let such clutter accumulate? She was dazed and more than a little frightened by the ugly, animate wreckage. "They're called neuroses," spoke Robert's inner voice. He knew what they were looking at, and was fighting a terror far worse than hers. "I'd forgotten so many of these things. I had no idea they were still here." Robert stared at his enemies below, and Athaclena saw that many of the faces below were warped, angry versions of his own. "This is my job now, Clenny. We learned long before contact that there is only one way to deal with a mess like this. Truth is the only weapon that works. The boat rocked as Robert's metaphoric self turned and dove into the molten pool of pain.
Robert!
Froth rose. The tiny craft began to buck and heave, forcing her to hold tightly to the rim. Bright, awful hurt sprayed on all sides, and down near the grating a terrific struggle was taking place. In the outer world, Robert's face ran streams of perspiration. Athaclena wondered how much more of this he could take. Hesitantly, she sent her image hand down into the pool. Direct contact burned, but she pushed on, reaching for the grating. Something grabbed her hand. She yanked back, but the grip held. An awful thing wearing a horrid version of Robert's face leered up at her with an expression twisted almost out of recognition by some warped lust. The thing pulled hard, trying to drag her into the noisome pool. Athaclena screamed. Another shape streaked in to grapple with her assailant. The scaly hold on her arm released, and she fell back into the boat. Then the little craft started speeding away. All around her, the lake of pain flowed toward the drain, but her boat moved rapidly the other way, upstream against the flow.
Robert is pushing me out, she realized.
Contact narrowed, then broke. The metaphorical images ceased abruptly. Athaclena blinked rapidly in a daze. She knelt on the soft ground. Robert held her hand, breathing through clenched teeth.
Had to stop you, Clenny. That was dangerous for you. But you are in such pain.
He shook his head.
You showed me where the block was. I can take care of that neurotic garbage now that I know it's there. At least well enough for now. And have I told you yet that a guy wouldn't have any trouble at all falling in love with you?
Athaclena sat up abruptly, amazed at the non sequitur. She held up the three gas ampules.
Robert, you must tell me which of these drugs will ease the pain, yet leave you conscious enough to help me.
He squinted.
The blue one. Snap it under my nose, but don't breathe any yourself. No telling what para-endorphins would do to you.
When Athaclena broke the ampule, a small, dense cloud of vapor spilled out. About half went in with Robert's next breath. The rest quickly dispersed. With a deep, shuddering sigh, Robert's body seemed to uncoil. He looked up at her again with a new light in his eyes.
I don't know if I could have maintained consciousness much longer, but it was almost worth it, sharing my mind with you.
In his aura, it seemed that a simple but elegant version of Zunur Thuzun danced. Athaclena was momentarily taken aback.
You are a very strange creature, Robert.
She paused. The Zunur Thuzun. It was gone now. But she had not imagined kenning that glyph. How could Robert have learned to make it? Athaclena nodded and smiled. The human mannerisms came easily, as if imprinted.
I was just thinking the same thing, Robert. I too, found it worthwhile.
Chapter 13 Fibbin. Just above a cliff face, near the rim of a narrow mesa, dust still rose in plumes where some recent crashing force had torn a long, ugly furrow in the ground. A dagger-shaped stretch of forest had been shattered in a few violent seconds by a plunging thing that roared and skipped and struck again, sending earth and vegetation spraying in all directions, before finally coming to rest just short of the sheer precipice. It had happened at night. Not far away, other pieces of even hotter sky debris had cracked stone and set fires. But here the impact had been only a glancing blow. Long minutes after the explosive noise of collision ebbed, there remained other disturbances. Landslides rattled down the nearby cliff, and trees near the tortured path creaked and swayed. At the end of the furrow, the dark object that had wreaked this havoc emitted crackling, snapping sounds as superheated metal met a cool fog sweeping up from the valley below. At last, things settled down and began returning to normal. Native animals nosed out into the open again. A few even approached, sniffed the hot thing in distaste, then moved on about the more serious business of living one more day. It had been a bad landing. Within the escape pod, the pilot did not stir. That night and another day passed without any sign of motion. At last, with a cough and a low groan, Fibbon awoke.
"Where? What?" he croaked.
His first organized thought was to notice that he had just spoken Anglic.
"That's good," he considered numbly. "No brain damage, then."
A neo-chimpanzee's ability to use language was his crucial possession, and far too easily lost. Speech aphasia was a good way to get reassessed, maybe even registered as a genetic probationer. Of course, samples of Fibbon's plasm had already been sent to Earth, and it was probably too late to recall them. So, did it really matter if he were reassessed? He had never really cared what color his procreation card was, anyway. Or, at least, he didn't care any more than the average chim did.
"Oh, so we're getting philosophical now. Delaying the inevitable? No dithering, Fibbon old chim. Move. Open your eyes. Grope yourself. Make sure everything's still attached."
Wryly put, but less easily done. Fibbon groaned as he tried to lift his head. He was so dehydrated that separating his eyelids felt like prying apart a set of rusty drawers. At last, he managed to squint. He saw that the clear shield of the pod was cracked and streaked with soot. Thick layers of dirt and seared vegetation had been speckled, sometimes since the crash, by droplets of light rain. Fibbon discovered one of the reasons for his disorientation. The capsule was canted more than 50 degrees. He fumbled with the seat's straps until they released, letting him slump against the armrest. He gathered a little strength, then pounded on the jammed hatch, muttering hoarse curses until the catch finally gave way in a rain of leaves and small pebbles. Several minutes of dry sneezing ensued, finishing with him draped over the hatch rim, breathing hard. Fibbon gritted his teeth.
"Come on," he muttered subvocally. "Let's get out of here."
He heaved himself up, ignoring the uncomfortable warmth of the outer shell and the screaming of his own bruises. He squirmed desperately through the opening, turning and reaching for a foothold outside. He felt dirt, blessed ground. But when he let go of the hatch, his left ankle refused to support him. He toppled over and landed with a painful thump.
"Ow!"
Fibbon said aloud. He reached underneath and pulled forth a sharp stick that had pierced his ship briefs. He glared at it before throwing it aside, then sagged back upon the mound of debris surrounding the pod. Ahead of him, about 20 feet away, dawn's light showed the edge of a steep drop-off. The sound of rushing water rose from far below. He thought in bemused wonder at his near demise.
"Another few meters and I wouldn't have been so thirsty right now."
With the rising sun, the mountainside across the valley became clearer, revealing smoky, scorched trails where larger pieces of space junk had come down. "So much for old Proconsul," Fibbon Thibben thought. 7,000 years of loyal service to 50 big-time galactic races, only to be splattered all over a minor planet by one Thibben Bolger, client of Wolfling's, semi-skilled militia pilot. What an undignified end for a gallant old warrior. But he had outlived the scout boat, after all, by a little while at least. Someone once said that one measure of sentience was how much energy a sophant spent on matters other than survival. Thibben's body felt like a slab of half-broiled meat, yet he found the strength to grin. He had fallen a couple million miles and might yet live to someday tell some smart-aleck two generations further uplifted grandkids all about it. He patted the scorched ground beside him and laughed in a voice dry with thirst.
Beat that, Tarzan!
Chapter 14 Utha Calling.
We are here as friends of galactic tradition, protectors of propriety and honor, enforcers of the will of the ancient ones who founded the way of things so long ago.
Utha Calding was not very strong in Galactic 3, so he used his portable secretary to record the Gubru invasion manifesto for later study. He listened with only half an ear while going about completing the rest of his preparations. With only half an ear. His corona chirped a spark of amusement when he realized he had used the phrase in his thoughts. The human metaphor actually made his own ears itch. The Chims nearby had their receivers turned to the Anglic translation, also being broadcast from the Gubru ships. It was an unofficial version of the manifesto, since Anglic was considered only a wolfling tongue, unsuitable for diplomacy. Utha Calding crafted Liuthsitsaka, the approximate equivalence of a nose, thumb, and raspberry at the invaders. One of his neo-chimpanzee assistants looked up at him with a puzzled expression. The Chim must have some latent psi ability, he realized. The other three hairy clients crouched under a nearby tree, listening to the doctrine of the invading armada. In accordance with protocol and all of the rules of war, a rescript has been delivered to Earth, explaining our grievances and our demands for redress. Utha Calding set one last seal into place over the hatch of the diplomatic cache. The pyramidal structure stood on a bluff overlooking the Sea of Silmar, just southwest of the other buildings of the Timbrimi Embassy. Out over the ocean, all seemed fair and spring-like. Even today, small fishing boats cruised out on the placid waters, as if the sky held nothing unfriendlier than the dappled clouds. In the other direction, though, past a small grove of Thula greatgrass, transplanted from his home world, Utha Calding's chancery and official quarters lay empty and abandoned. Strictly speaking, he could have remained at his post, but Utha Calding had no wish to trust the invaders' word that they were still following all the rules of war. The Gubru were renowned for interpreting tradition to suit themselves. Anyway, he had made plans. Utha Calding finished the seal and stepped back from the diplomatic cache. Offset from the embassy itself, sealed and warded, it was protected by millions of years of precedent. The chancery and other embassy buildings might be fair game, but the invader would be hard-pressed to come up with a satisfactory excuse for breaking into this sacrosanct depository. Still, Utha Calding smiled. He had confidence in the Gubru. When he had backed away about 10 meters, he concentrated and crafted a simple glyph, then cast it toward the top of the pyramid, where a small blue globe spun silently. The warder brightened at once and let out an audible hum. Uther Calving then turned and approached the waiting Chims.
List as our first grievance that the Earthlings' client race, formerly known as Terciops amicus or Neo-Dolphin, has made a discovery which they do not share. It is said that this discovery portends major consequences to galactic society. The clan of Guxiu Gubru, as a protector of tradition and the inheritance of the progenitors, will not be excluded. It is our legitimate right to take hostages to force those half-formed water creatures and their wolfling masters to divulge their hoarded information.
A small corner of Uther Calding's thoughts wondered just what the human's other client race had discovered out there beyond the galactic disk. He sighed wistfully. The way things worked in the five galaxies, he would have to take a long voyage through D-level hyperspace and emerge a million years from now to find out the entire story. By then, of course, it would be ancient history. In fact, exactly what Streaker had done to trigger the present crisis hardly mattered, really. The Timbrimi Grand Council had calculated that an explosion of some sort was due within a few centuries anyway. The Earthlings had just managed to set it off a bit early. That was all.
Set it off early.
Uther Calving hunted for the right metaphor. It was as if a child had escaped from a cradle, crawled straight into a den of Vilkorg beasts, and slapped the queen right in the snout.
Second grievance, and the precipitate cause for our anomic intervention here, is our strong suspicion that uplift irregularities are taking place on the planet Garth. In our possession is evidence that the semi-sentient client species known as Neo-Chimpanzee is being given improper guidance and is not being properly served by either its human patrons or its Timbrimi consorts.
The Timbrimi? Improper consorts? Oh, you arrogant avians shall pay for that insult,
Uther Calving vowed. The Chims hurried to their feet and bowed low when he approached. Sealf Kuan glimmered briefly at the tips of his corona as he returned the gesture.
I wish to have certain messages delivered. Will you serve me?
They all nodded. The Chims were obviously uncomfortable with each other, coming as they did from such different social strata. One was dressed proudly in the uniform of a militia officer. Two others wore bright civilian clothes. The last and most shabbily dressed Chim bore a kind of breast panel display, with an array of keys on both sides, which let the poor creature perform a semblance of speech. This one stood a little behind and apart from the others, and barely lifted his gaze from the ground.
"We are at your service," said the clean-cut young lieutenant, snapping to attention.
He seemed completely aloof to the sour glances the gaudily clad civilians cast his way.
"That is good, my young friend."
Uther Calving grasped the Chim's shoulder and held out a small black cube.
"Please deliver this to Planetary Coordinator On Eagle, with my compliments. Tell her that I had to delay my own departure to Sanctuary, but I hope to see her soon." "I am not really lying,"
Uther Calving reminded himself.
"Bless Anglic and its lovely ambiguity."
The Chim lieutenant took the cube and bowed again at precisely the correct angle for showing bipedal respect to a senior patron ally. Without even looking at the others, he took off at a run toward his courier bike. One of the civilians, apparently thinking Uther Calving would not overhear, whispered to his brightly clad colleague.
I hope the blue-card Pom skids on a mud puddle and gets his shiny uniform all wet.
Uther Calling pretended not to notice. It sometimes paid to let others believe Timbrimmy hearing was as bad as their eyesight.
These are for you, he told the two in the flashy clothes,
and he tossed each of them a small bag. The money inside was Gal coin, untraceable and unquestionable through war and turmoil, for it was backed by the contents of the great library itself. The two Chims bowed to Uther Calling, trying to imitate the officer's precision. He had to suppress a delighted laugh, for he sensed their foci, each Chim's center of consciousness, had gathered in the hand holding the purse, excluding nearly all else from the world.
Go, then, and spend it as you will. I thank you for your past services.
The two members of Port Helena's small criminal underworld spun about and dashed off through the grove. Borrowing another human metaphor, they had been his eyes and ears since he had arrived here. No doubt they considered their work completed now.
And thank you for what you are about to do, Uther Calling thought after them.
He knew this particular band of probationers well. They would spend his money well and gain an appetite for more. In a few days, there would be only one source of such coin. They would have new employers soon, Uther Calling was sure.
Have come as friends and protectors of pre-sentient peoples to see that they are given proper guidance and membership in a dignified clan.
Only one Chim remained, trying to stand as straight as he could, but the poor creature could not help shifting his weight nervously, grinning anxiously.
And what?
Uther Calling stopped abruptly. His tendrils waved, and he turned to look out over the sea. A streak of light appeared from the headland across the bay, spearing up and eastward into the sky. Uther Calling shaded his eyes, but he did not waste time envying earthling vision. The glowing ember climbed into the clouds, leaving a kind of trail that only he could detect. It was a shimmering of joyful departure that surged and then faded in a few brief seconds, unraveling with the faint white contrail.
Athushushutin,
his aide, secretary, and friend, was flying their ship out through the heart of the battle fleet surrounding Garth. And who could tell? Their Timbrimmy-made craft was specially built. He even might get through. That was not Athushushutin's job, of course. His task was merely to make the attempt. Uther Calling reached forth in kenning. Yes, something did ride down that burst of light. A sparkling legacy. He drew in Athushushutin's final glyph and stored it in a cherished place, should he ever make it home to tell the brave Tim's loved ones. Now there were only two Timbrimmy on Garth, and Athaclena was as safe as could be provided for. It was time for Uther Calving to see to his own fate.
To rescue these innocent creatures from the warped uprearing they are receiving at the hands of wolflings and criminals.
He turned back to the little Chim, his last helper.
And what about you, Jojo? Do you want a task as well?
Jojo fumbled with the keys of his panel display.
Yes, please. Help you is all I ask.
Uther Calling smiled. He had to hurry off and meet Kalt. By now, the Thenanin ambassador would be nearly frantic, pacing beside Uther Calling's pinnace. But the fellow could just wait a few moments more.
Yes, he told Jojo. I think there is something you can do for me. Do you think you can keep a secret?
The little genetic reject nodded vigorously, his soft brown eyes filled with earnest devotion. Uther Kolving had spent a lot of time with Jojo, teaching him things the schools here on Garth had never bothered to try. Wilderness survival skills and how to pilot a simple flitter, for instance. Jojo was not the pride of Neo-Chimp Uplift, but he had a great heart, and more than enough of a certain type of cunning that Uther Kolving appreciated.
"Do you see that blue light atop the cairn, Jojo?"
"Jojo remembers," the chim keyed. "Jojo remembers all you said."
"Good," Uther Kolving nodded. "I knew you would. I shall count on you, my dear little friend."
He smiled, and Jojo grinned back eagerly. Meanwhile, the computer-generated voice from space droned on, completing the manifesto of invasion.
"And give them over for adoption by some appropriate elder clan, one that will not lead them into improper behavior."
"Wordy birds," Uther Kolving thought. "Silly things, really."
"We'll show them some improper behavior, won't we, Jojo?"
The little chim nodded nervously. He grinned, even though he did not entirely understand. Chapter 15. Athoclina. That night their tiny campfire cast yellow and orange flickerings against the trunks of the near oaks.
"I was so hungry, even Vac-Pak stew tasted delicious,"
Robert sighed as he put aside his bowl and spoon.
"I'd planned to make us a meal of baked plate ivy roots, but I don't guess either of us will have much appetite for that delicacy soon."
Athoclina felt she understood Robert's tendency to make irrelevant remarks like these. Tim Brimmy and Terran both had ways of making light of disaster, part of the unusual pattern of similarity between the two species. She had eaten sparingly herself. Her body had nearly purged the peptides left over from the gear reaction, but she still felt a little sore after this afternoon's adventure. Overhead, a dark band of galactic dust clouds spanned fully 20% of the sky, outlined by bright hydrogen nebulae. Athoclina watched the starry vault, her corona only slightly puffed out above her ears. From the forest she felt the tiny anxious emotions of little native creatures.
"Robert?"
"Hmm? Yes, Clenny?"
"Robert, why did you remove the crystals from our radio?"
After a pause, his voice was serious, subdued.
"I'd hope not to have to tell you for a few days, Athoclina. But last night, I saw the communication satellites being destroyed. That could only mean the Galactics have arrived, as our parents expected. The radio's crystals can be picked up by shipborne resonance detectors, even when they aren't powered. I took ours out so that there'd be no chance of being found that way. It's standard doctrine."
Athoclina felt a tremor at the tip of her ruff, just above her nose, that shivered over her scalp and down her back.
"So it has begun."
Hardifer longed to be with her father. It still hurt that he had sent her away rather than allow her to stay at his side where she could help him. The silence stretched. She kenned Robert's nervousness. Twice he seemed about to speak, then stopped, thinking better of it. Finally she nodded.
"I agree with your logic in removing the crystals, Robert. I even think I understand the protective impulse that made you refrain from telling me about it. You should not do that again, though. It was foolish."
Robert agreed, seriously.
"I won't, Athoclina."
They lay in silence for a while, until Robert reached over with his good hand and touched hers.
Clenny, I want you to know I'm grateful. You saved my life.
Robert,
she sighed tiredly.
But it goes beyond that. When you came into my mind, you showed me things about myself, things I'd never known before. That's an important favor. You can read all about it in textbooks if you want. Self-deception and neuroses are two particularly insidious human plagues.
They are not unique to humans, Robert.
No, I guess not. What you saw in my mind was probably nothing by pre-contact standards. But given our history, well, even the sanest of us needs reminding from time to time.
Athaclena had no idea what to say, so she remained silent. To have lived in humanity's awful dark ages must have been frightening indeed. Robert cleared his throat.
What I'm trying to say is that I know how far you've gone to adapt yourself, learning human expressions, making little changes in your physiology.
An experiment.
She shrugged, another human mannerism. She suddenly realized that her face felt warm. Capillaries were opening in that human reaction she had thought so quaint. She was blushing.
Yeah, an experiment. But by rights, it ought to go both ways, Clenny. Timbrimi are renowned around the five galaxies for their adaptability. But we humans are capable of learning a thing or two also.
She looked up.
What do you mean, Robert?
I mean that I'd like you to show me some more about Timbrimi ways, your customs. I want to know what your landsmen do that's equivalent to an amazed stare, or a nod, or a grin.
Again there was a flicker. Athaclena's corona reached, but the delicate, simple, ghostly glyph he had formed vanished like smoke. Perhaps he was not even aware he had crafted it.
She said, blinking and shaking her head. I cannot be sure, Robert, but I think perhaps you have already begun.
Robert was stiff and feverish when they struck camp the next morning. He could only take so much anesthetic for his fractured arm and remain able to walk. Athaclena stashed most of his gear in the notch of a gum beech tree and cut slashes in the bark to mark the site. Actually, she doubted anyone would ever be back to reclaim it.
I must get you to a physician, she said, feeling his brow.
His raised temperature clearly was not a good sign. Robert indicated a narrow slot between the mountains to the south.
Over that way, 2 days' march, there's the Mendoza Freehold. Mrs. Mendoza was a nurse practitioner before she married Juan and took up farming.
Athaclena looked uncertainly at the pass. They would have to climb nearly 1,000 meters to get over it.
Robert, are you sure this is the best route? I'm certain I have intermittently sensed sophonts emoting from much nearer, over that line of hills to the east.
Robert leaned on his makeshift staff and began moving up the southward trail.
Come on, Clenny, he said over his shoulder. I know you want to meet a Garthling, but now's hardly the time. We can go hunting for native presentience after I've been patched up.
Athaclena stared after him, astonished by the illogic of his remark. She caught up with him.
Robert, that was a strange thing to say. How can I think of seeking out native creatures, no matter how mysterious, until you were tended? The sophonts I have felt to the east were clearly humans and chimps, although I admit there was a strange added element, almost like...
Aha! Robert smiled, as if she had made a confession. He walked on. Amazed, Athaclena tried to probe his feelings, But the human's discipline and determination was incredible for a member of a wolfling race. All she could tell was that he was disturbed, and that it had something to do with her mention of sapient thoughts east of here. Oh, to be a true telepath! Once more she wondered why the Timbrimi Grand Council had not defied the rules of the Uplift Institute and gone ahead to develop the capability. She had sometimes envied humans the privacy they could build around their lives and resented the gossipy invasiveness of her own culture. But right now she wanted only to break in there and find out what he was hiding. Her corona waved, and if there had been any Timbrimi within half a mile, they would have winced at her angry, pungent opinion of the way of things. Robert was showing difficulty before they reached the crest of the first ridge, little more than an hour later. Athaclena knew by now that the glistening perspiration on his brow meant the same thing as a reddening and fluffing of a Timbrimi's corona, overheating. When she overheard him counting under his breath, she knew that they would have to rest. "No," he shook his head. His voice was ragged. "Let's just get past this ridge and into the next valley. From there on, it's shaded all the way to the pass." Robert kept trudging.
"There is shade enough here," she insisted, and pulled him over to a rock jumble covered by creepers with umbrella-like leaves, all linked by the ubiquitous transfer vines to the forest and the valley floor. Robert sighed as she helped him sit back against a boulder in the shade. She wiped his forehead, then began unwrapping his splinted right arm. He hissed through his teeth. A faint purpling discolored the skin near where the bone had broken.
"These are bad signs, aren't they, Robert?"
For a moment she felt him begin to dissemble, then he reconsidered, shaking his head.
"No, I think there's an infection. I'd better take some more universal."
He started to reach for her pack, where his aid kit was being carried, but his equilibrium failed, and Athaclena had to catch him.
"Enough, Robert. You cannot walk to the Mendoza Freehold. I certainly cannot carry you, and I'll not leave you alone for 2 or 3 days. You seem to have some reason to wish to avoid the people who I sensed to the east of here. But whatever it is, it cannot match the importance of saving your life."
Robert let her pop a pair of blue pills into his mouth and sipped from the canteen she held for him.
"All right, Clenny," he sighed.
"We'll turn eastward. Only promise you'll corona sing for me, will you? It's lovely, like you are, and it helps me understand you better. And now, I think we'd better get started because I'm babbling. That's one sign that a human being is deteriorating. You should know that by now."
Athaclena's eyes spread apart, and she smiled.
"I was already aware of that, Robert. Now tell me, what is the name of this place where we are going?"
"It's called the Howlett Center. It's just past that second set of hills over that way." He pointed east by southeast.
"They don't like surprise guests," he went on. "So we'll want to talk loudly as we approach."